So we're going to talk about securing your information in a target-rich environment. And this is one of those. I'm used to going to hacker conferences where, you know, and this is so much like a hacker conference, and there's like a lot of partying and a lot of drinking. It's not like hacker conferences in there's a lot of machines that just haven't been patched. So that's actually kind of fun. So my name is Darren Kitchen, and I'm a hacker. And I got my start on irc.dal.net and Pound Freaks. So what that means is in the 90s, I hung out in chat rooms when chat rooms were cool. And I learned about phone freaking, and that's basically hacking the phone system back when it was cool to get free long distance. And I spent my youth learning about this stuff and like riding my bike around the neighborhoods and talking to linemen on the side of the road who at first are like, oh, some kid interested in what I do? That's kind of cool. And then suddenly you're like, oh, so is that pair gain? And are you doing pulse code modulation? And they're like, whoa, what just happened? Which is pretty cool because then all of a sudden they're like, oh, because they got into it in the 60s with these little blue boxes which made crazy tones and got them free long distance. Now we're using red ones that do different tones and get free phone calls from payphones. And that was definitely a lure from the beginning. But the more that I got into it, the more that I realized that's just a parlor trick. You know, ooh, free phone calls. You go to Gmail and it's been free for the last couple of years through Gmail. So that really led to learning more and more about the system. And the more you learn about the system, the more you realize how it's built upon trusts. And that's how I ended up getting a little bit too curious about how the phone system works. And maybe breaking into some phone boxes with a couple friends and taking some photos of stuff inside so that we could write down the serial numbers, you know, and get some of those notes that are on the inside. And that's really cool because then when you've got those serial numbers and you know who the manufacturer is, you can call up and say, you know, the Harris Corporation who makes this phone box that goes inside a remote terminal on the side of the road that basically runs the entire Star 69 thing. Remember Star 69? That was fun. And then you can call up and kind of sound like you know what you're talking about, and then they'll hopefully give you some information. And that was a lot of fun. What's not fun is the fact that in the 90s, digital cameras were really hard to come by. If you could find one, maybe it took a floppy in the side. And so we didn't have that, nor did we have a Polaroid. So my buddy who took the photos, we learned the hard way what it means to take your stuff to a one-hour Photoshop and then have the Photoshop make duplicates and take those to the police. So I put down the hacking for a little bit and focused on the IT stuff and did the systems administration thing for 10 years. So I've paid my dues, and somewhere around 2005, I realized, you know, what I missed about the hacking scene were e-zines. So I used to do all this security research then, you know, about the phone networks, and I would contribute what I've learned back to the hacker community by writing these cool things called e-zines, which is like, or a zine or whatever. And those are basically text files that get traded amongst bulletin board systems and F-serves on IRC. And it's like a newspaper or a variety mag with all sorts of interesting bits. And since my code sucks, I couldn't contribute to the community with, you know, Hello World and Python. So I decided I'm going to go ahead and do this research, find out about the direct access test units, how you can remotely tap phone lines and things like that, and publish this stuff. And there's a bunch of different venues, FRAC, 2600, the Hacker Quarterly is still going in print. And so that's a fun one. And is it on Kindle, really? Yeah. Oh, that's fantastic. So I did the e-zine thing. And so in 05, when I was thinking about what is it about the hacker scene that I miss, don't get me wrong, like IRC can be a lot of fun. Sometimes there can be drama on the, I know it's weird, but I missed presenting information, and that's why I started a podcast. So I do Hack 5. It's a tech variety show. It started in August 05, and we've been going for almost 7 years now. So it's really fun because I get to take basically the same thing we used to do in those e-zines and bring it to a new generation, because now nobody's going to sit through a text file. You know, it's audio, it's video, it's got to be rich. And I decided to really hone my craft with presenting and try to find a way to take complex hacker material and break it down for a general audience so that everybody can, like, hopefully I can foster a new generation of hackers that aren't going to be what's known as script kiddies. And that is kids that just know how to run a program and point it at a server, and then they call themselves anonymous, and they're like, whoa, hey, look, we broke into something. It's like, good luck, all right. But I'm going to go check out the Legion movie because that sounds cool. So yeah, that's Hack 5. And through that, I've been given some great opportunities to do fantastic work with G4 Tech TV. If you guys don't mind, just turn the volume off on your phones in case you're... Anyway. So G4 Tech TV, I had the cool opportunity in 06 to do a call for help with Lee Laporte up in Canada. And then that led to doing cool stuff with the Revision 3 network, with Twit, and with CNET. So, you know, it's been a lot of fun. It's opened a lot of doors. And it really wasn't something that I set off to, like, I'm gonna start a podcasting company. I'm going to get some venture capitalists and some creative people, and we're going to set off to... No, I just kind of started it because in between drinking beers and hacking seems like a fun thing to do, right? And at a certain point, where are you going to go? You're going to go to Toronto, New York, or San Francisco. So a year and a half ago, I set off on an epic month-long road trip across the country with cameras and hacking gear and just traveled the world learning about our friends and fans, crashing on their couches, and doing a little bit of hacking. And that's how I found my way to the Bay Area, where I continue to do Hack 5 now. And I kind of consider myself a security researcher, which is a hacker with a paycheck. And a security researcher, I don't know, to me, when I thought about like security researcher as like a child, like what I really wanted to be, not like some boffin behind a desk writing code, but I kind of wanted to be this guy. That guy's cool. I mean, look at all those toys, right? I mean, he's shooting a missile out of his cast. You can't beat that. So yes, I wanted to be Q. And it's through all of that and the toys that I've built and things like that and all the research that I've really come to realize what the majority of these physical hacking and things of that, taking the code into the meat space, is really all about convenience and trust models. So I'm going to take a quick poll. Who here is familiar with IEEE 802.11 management frames? Don't be shy, just raise your hand. All right. And who's familiar with USB human interface class specifications? All right. Well, if you don't, feel free to throw one of these at me. And not the puppy. So there's a huge conference in DC every year called ShmooCon. And if you ever have the opportunity to go, I guarantee you, you will be welcome there with the rest of the hackers. And they do things a little differently at conferences. And I know that they don't do this at South by Southwest. At ShmooCon, they issue you these little orange balls, and they're called Shmoo balls. And you are encouraged to, while you're in the talk, if you feel like calling out bullshit, go ahead and throw it at me. I realize you don't have that, so feel free to throw your phones or whatever you have, or just yell at me. That's totally cool. But people get into it at ShmooCon. This guy built a launcher thing. I would not like to be a panelist with him in my talk, but that's Larry Pesci. He's kind of awesome. Anyway. Quick disclaimer, by participating in this panel, you agree to be hacked for demonstration purposes. Don't worry, I'm only replacing the internet with kittens. And the tools demonstrated in this panel are totally legit devices that comply with all the necessary specifications, regulations, you know, Part 15, FCC, all that fun stuff. And they're used by the government and penetration testers for stuff. So, roadmap. We're going to be talking about vulnerabilities that you may encounter at a conference like this. We're going to do a couple of demos. I'm going to give you some tips on how you can protect yourself at a place like this against these kinds of attacks. And kittens are doing what they've always been doing on the internet. But before the hacking begins, anybody tell me what this is? Yes. Vinyl record. That is a vinyl record. What about this? Yeah, okay, so what's the difference? Well, some may argue actually that the vinyl has better quality. I'm not here to make that argument, but which is more convenient? Well, definitely the tape. Yeah. And then what's even more convenient than the tape is one of these, right? You can skip the tracks. And aside from in the 90s when people would come by the lunch table and tap on your Discman and make it skip or whatever, it was pretty fantastic. Well, then how did we get here? What is this? I have no tangible or emotional connection to the music. It's a commodity. And yet it's so convenient that it has replaced these liner notes and these wonderful discs that we used to have. And actually, some may argue that an MP3, and I don't care what bitrate you got, is not the same kind of quality as either of those three. I mean, yes, the tape was at 22.5 kilohertz, and CD is double that at 44.1. So, you know, there is, anyway, I'm not going to get into FLAC and AUG and formats like that, but this is successful because it's convenient. And as I know, convenience always trumps quality. Here's another example. Anybody know what this is? Yeah, so I've got a bunch of Super 8 back home. It's pretty cool. My dad used to shoot Super 8, and I found one recently. It's a Super 8 he shot of the television set during the Apollo moon landings, and it's labeled. I know I can't. I've got to find some way to transcode this somehow. That's the only problem with this old media. It's like, where are you going to find a player, right?
But actually, I know.
Like, yeah. Talk to you afterwards. Okay, and so it was pretty cool because it was labeled. The moon men and the moon maidens they brought back. And I'm like, dude, that's my dad. But, you know, this stuff was pretty cool, but then this stuff came out. And as you can see, much more convenient. And as long as you're kind and rewind, everything's going to be cool, right? Well, this is so much more convenient. And then somehow we got to this. Again, it's so much more convenient, and yet you've all experienced it. How is a Netflix on your grandmother's DSL going to be better than a 9 megabit MPEG-2 file on even a DVD, let alone Blu-ray? And so as we continue, there's like this huge drop-off where I've realized that everyone is willing to sacrifice so much quality for convenience. And it's weird because we're in the infancy of this stuff. We're also in the same trend. We've also decided that it's okay to give up security for convenience because this stuff is hard. Math is hard. Let's go shopping, right? Well, it's all about trust. Do you trust your computer? Does your computer trust you? Does your computer trust the other computer? And do you trust the other person? Anyway, those are the four trust models. And of course, the computer trusts us. We created the computer. We made it to do our commands. So why wouldn't it trust us, right? And why wouldn't we trust anything that it gives back to us? Because we programmed it as so, right? So now we're going to get into the fun bits where we talk about IEEE 802.11 management frames. So who's IEEE? Anybody know these guys? Yep. They're an institution of electrical and electronics engineers, and they are a nonprofit organization that have been doing cool standards and stuff since the 60s. I believe they're actually here. And they make the cool stuff that we all know and love, like Ethernet and Wi-Fi, and we kind of don't think about it because it all just works, right? They make this cool standard called 802.11. Thankfully, we all know it as Wi-Fi because that's kind of a, like, what are we talking about here, really? There's a bunch of them. There's 802.11 1997. It's known as Legacy. That's how old Wi-Fi is that we know of it. And then there's A and B, came out in 99. And then G and 03, which brought in, like, you know, more megabits. And the new one, N, is pretty cool. And then AC is coming in 2015. And through all of these, they all contain, you know, a bunch of management frames and stuff. And thankfully, we all know it as Wi-Fi. And what does Wi-Fi have in common with this right here? Yeah, exactly. The Wi-Fi spectrum that we all know and love is both the 5 gigahertz range and the 2.4 gigahertz range. 2.4 gigahertz actually shares some of its spectrum with your microwave oven, which is specifically on 2.45 gigahertz. So if you're ever like microwaving your burrito and you're wondering why your iPhone can't download something, that's why. And it's pretty cool that we have this spectrum because this used to be actually reserved for microwaves and medical equipment. It's actually this thing known as the ISM band, or Industrial, Scientific, and Medical band. And then the FCC was all like, hey, you know what would be cool if we gave this spectrum to the consumers so they can make cool stuff. So it's totally unlicensed, and you can do any kind of fun stuff you want on it. So as such, warning, we're going to talk science, as such, there needs to be a way to control the communications because there's a lot of crazy stuff in the air on those frequencies. And so nothing's going to work if we don't set some basic control protocols, management protocols to make sure that everything can communicate. Normally, you guys don't think about this. It just works. But this is the crazy stuff that goes on in the background. And the more you research about the protocol, and how it works in the underlying infrastructure, the more you realize that it's built on trust. So there's three basic control frames in Wi-Fi. There's an ACK or acknowledgement. Basically what happens is this laptop was talking to this laptop. It would send some data and it would wait for this one to send back an acknowledgement frame. And if it didn't hear an acknowledgement frame after a certain period of time has elapsed, it'd be like, oh, I must not have gotten it. All right, I'll send it again. And so that's what an acknowledgement frame is. There's also a request to send and a clear to send, which is basically saying, all right, it's been quiet for a minute. Nobody else is talking. Do you mind if we have a quick conversation? And then it'll be like, all right, yeah, it's totally cool. Let's just talk. And then other people listening by will be like, oh, well, I'm not going to send my request to send because they're obviously talking. In a nutshell, that's the way it works. Then there's these management frames. There's a bunch of them. And so the first interesting one is called a beacon. So a wireless access point sends out these management frames called beacons, which are basically big advertisements that say, hey, I'm XYZ network. I'm a Linksys. I'm a Netgear. I'm on channel 11. I'm running at 54 megabits per second. I use this kind of authentication scheme. I'm going to need this password or whatever. And it's just kind of like advertising and saying, hey, come join me. I'm cool. Then there are probe requests. Those come from, say, a laptop or a cell phone or a tablet. And those probe requests are sent out that say, hey, is such and such network around? I'm looking for Linksys here. Anybody know if Linksys is SXSW2012 around? I'm looking for that one. And so if the access point nearby hears that probe request and is that access point, it will respond with a properly configured probe response that says, hey, yeah, that's me. I am the network you're looking for. Come on over. Here are the specifications that you're going to need to know to talk to me. I'm on these channels, yada, yada. And from that, these machines can now begin the process of association. There's a request and response for that. There's also some management stuff for disassociation. If you don't want to talk to them anymore, it's all like talk to the hand, what's up? And reassociation, of course. And then there's authentication, which we all know and love, typing in our password and whatnot, and then deauthentication. So why are we talking about management frames? Well, because it's more fun than talking about Twitter. Because it's an epic love story between a client and an access point. And this is how it looks. So the client's going to send out this probe request saying, hey, is my Linksys network around? And then there's going to be a probe reply that says, yeah, I'm Linksys network. And then notice the ACK or the acknowledgement, like, okay, cool, I heard that. All right. And then there's a little authentication that takes place. And then it sends an ACK back, cool, I got your authentication. And then there will be an association request followed by an association response. And then finally, they're all connected and they're all happy. They can be BFF and start transmitting data. And that's convenient, super convenient, because you don't have to think about, can you imagine if you had to craft those packets and worry about the protocol? You don't care about that. You just want to open up your laptop. You want to turn on your tablet or your phone. You just want it to connect to the network so you can look at kitten photos. And yet, the way that our phones and our tablets and our computers work is that by default it's going to go ahead and remember those associations, those connections to those access points for convenience sake. When you go to the office, you turn on your laptop, it automatically connects to the office network. When you go home and you connect to the Wi-Fi there, it just happens automatically. You set it up once, you don't have to do it again. We would hate to have to inconvenience the user, so we're just going to go ahead in the protocol and take care of this. And that's why our phones have these like forget the network. You may have seen this on the iPhone where it says forget this network. It doesn't say remember this network. No. The default behavior is we're going to remember that. If you want to, you can forget it, but you have to do that every time. So I bring this up because I want to ask everybody, how's your karma? Karma is an awesome program written by Dino and then later taken over by my buddy Robin Wood. And it's the foundation of this cool project that we put together a couple years back that we call Yazaga. It's German for the yes man. And so the way that Yazaga works is that when your laptop or your tablet or your phone or whatever have you sends out these probe requests looking for the networks that it remembers, like the one that it remembers from your home or your office, the yes man does this thing. So your laptop says, hey, is Linksys around? It doesn't matter if Lynx is around. Actually, when you go home and if a Yasuga was around you, your laptop's still probing for SXSW 2012. Actually, if the South by Southwest people were smart, they wouldn't put the year in it, because then you'd come back next year and it would automatically connect for convenience. So that is one of the things that our Yasuga project does. It implements karma, and karma is a bitch. And so it's a very simple white lie, and yet it totally violates the inherent trust in these protocols. It allows us, as a hacker, to become what is known as the man in the middle. So now you're thinking, okay, big deal. So your access point replies to every SSID. It's like, remember in Harry Potter, the first Harry Potter film, where Harry looks into the mirror and he sees whatever he wants to see? It's the wireless access point equivalent of that. And so who cares, right? You're just providing me with the internet. Why is that a big deal if I connected to your access point versus the legitimate South by Southwest one? But once I'm in the man in the middle, there's a bunch of fun stuff we can do. And so we decided, as you do, we would package this project up and put it inside of a plastic pineapple, you know, with the board and a battery pack. Whoops, one of these here. Just because, you know, it's more fun that way. I think I mentioned earlier that I didn't set off to build a new media company or anything like that. I just kind of wanted to have some fun. And so I will continue to do that with all of my projects, because really this sounds a lot more fun than the wireless auditing penetration testing device, you know? So that's the Wi-Fi pineapple. And I'm bringing up Hackers for Charity because this was a moment where, like I said, we'd never started as, we're going to start a hacking company or a new media company. We're building these Wi-Fi pineapples. And for a year, we were having people knock down our door saying, will you build me one? I want a Wi-Fi pineapple. And it's like, yes, you can just do it yourself. You get this part off the shelf, that part off the shelf, these things. Break out the soldering iron. You know, you solder this bit to that bit. You flash the firmware. It's a really easy 35-step process. You'll have it done in a couple hours. People don't want to do that. So Johnny Long is a really cool hacker, and he started this nifty thing called Hackers for Charity. And they do awesome work in Uganda. They have a computer center there where they bring training and stuff to the locals, and he just does fantastic work. And so at a hacker conference a couple of years back, Johnny asked, he's like, your pineapples are just, they're so cool, man. I'm like, I know, I like my pineapples. And he says, would you donate one for Hackers for Charity for a silent auction? And I'm like, all right, sure, why not? Whatever, what could go wrong? You know, I mean, well, it raised $400, and I was like, hey, that's really cool. And then a light bulb went off, and it's like, huh, we could sell these to government agencies, and educational institutions, and penetration testers, which are security researchers, and hackers. So that's what we do now. Anybody remember the difference between a security researcher and a hacker? Paycheck. So I become your ISP when I am the man in the middle. You connect to Yasuga, you don't think anything of it, because your laptop does it automatically for you for convenience, and as far as you're concerned, you're connected to the South by Southwest network, or the Linksys, or the Marriott, or wherever it is that you think you're connecting to. And just like your ISP at home, just like Comcast, Time Warner, Cox Communications, AT&T, any of the others, just like them, I now have the ability to do a little bit of eavesdropping. Or like hackers like to call it, packet sniffing, which is a lot of fun, especially when you're using what's called clear text or plain text communications protocols, where basically you can just see everything as is. That's when you're not using HTTPS. I can do a little bit of phishing attacks. Those are a lot of fun. So you go over to Facebook.com, and you don't actually end up at Facebook.com. You end up at my version of Facebook.com, which I just willfully created exactly like the original, except for one minor difference. It doesn't actually log you into Facebook. It kind of just stores your password for me and then gives you an error. The best thing is to throw up an error that says incorrect password, because then what does the person do? Yes, tries every single, oh, is it the one I use for Bank of America? No, it's not that one. Maybe it's the one I use for my work VPN, right? And then now you've got their email address and their password for Facebook, so you can log in and data mine the hell out of it, as well as all of the other passwords they use for every other service. And then, you know, Bob's your uncle. Sidejacking, that's a really fun attack that you can do when you're the man in the middle. And there are lots of ways to become the man in the middle. You don't have to use a pineapple. You don't have to use Yasuga and become a fake access point. You can But there's a bunch of other fun ways that hackers can do this if you're on, say, an open network, which you should not be connecting to. But sidejacking is pretty cool. It actually got a lot of press here recently with anybody familiar with the tool FireSheep? It was a Firefox extension that allowed you to, on a wireless network, and an open wireless network like you would find at Starbucks, the ATT Wi-Fi we all connect to and don't think anything of. And if you're sitting in Starbucks running this program, you could fire up this this FireSheep program, which allows you to do sidejacking. And so what would happen is it would listen specifically for cookies. I mean, it'd be eavesdropping on everything you're doing, but it's only interested in these cookies. It's a cookie monster. And so what it does, now that I have your cookie, is I can inject that cookie into my own browser session. And so if you went over to Facebook and logged in, it gave you a cookie, and that's how you guys are authenticated, so you can keep browsing without having to log into every single page you click. But if I have that cookie, I'm you as well. So it was pretty cool because it brought to light a very blindingly obvious hack that the security community has been screaming about for years and years and years, and that is when you don't secure your web traffic, I'm talking about like HTTPS, or however you want to secure it. If you don't secure it, and you're passing this cookie in plain text, anybody can come over and just sidejack that and become you. And so it's pretty cool because it got a lot of press and it made a lot of big sites actually go ahead and finally implement HTTPS as they should have. A lot of them did opt-in. Some of them still offer opt-out. Google got it right. And I believe it's the only way to log into Gmail. But that was a really cool one that brought some attention to this finally, and thankfully some things are changing there. Another thing you can do when you're somebody's ISP is do a little bit of code injection, so I can put my code into the data stream as it's going through. So you pull up, you know, bankofamerica.com, and then I give you bankofamerica.com, but I also add a little bit of JavaScript, which captures your keystrokes and sends them back to me, because that'd be fun, you know. I don't even have to give you a fake Bank of America website, you know, where I have to like put up the squirrel or the pigeon or whatever it is that you see when you log in, the little site icon. I don't have to worry about that if I've got a little JavaScript keylogger on there. And also kittens. So they are taking over the internet. So let's talk about hacking the conference. This one's fun. So I set off to hack this conference and decided to build a couple of different boxes with the Yazaga, with the Wi-Fi Pineapple. And this one right here is housed inside of this plastic enclosure. And it's rocking about 12 of these batteries that are known as 18650s. For the like people that care, it's 3,000 milliamp hours per battery at 3.7 volts. You know this battery. You don't think about it. It's in your laptop right now. 9,000 of these batteries are in the Tesla Roadster. So it's a pretty common battery. And with this pack, this thing will last like all day, all night. No problem. And the antenna's inside of it. It just has a like fun little button. Here's another one I built. This one's inside of a metal enclosure, so I put the antenna on the outside. Has another of those 12 batteries. And what's fun about this one is with a little bit of neodymium magnet action, I'm able to make it stick places. Does anybody notice it? Anybody notice it here? It's like, where's Waldo? You know, spot the box.
No.
Yep. This guy didn't spot it. He did notice it when I came up and I said, excuse me, after taking the photo. And he was just like, oh, pardon me, of course, yeah, whatever. So I go up to the side and I grab it. And this poor ATM is like made out of tinfoil, because when I pull it off, it's like, and at first he's all like, no worries, no worries. And then he's like, I'm like walking off with half the ATM after he's done his transaction. It was great. But nobody notices this because it's hidden in plain sight. It's a little urban camouflage. And this is what the back end looks like. I've changed some of the, I've hidden the MAC addresses to protect the innocent. And this is just a very quick sampling, but what you can see on the right are some host names. You can see at the very top, Mike's iPhone 3, BlackBerry, BlackBerry, BlackBerry. David iPhone, BlackBerry, way more BlackBerries. Ben's iPhone, a ton more BlackBerries, and Androids, and whatever have you. This is really fun to rock on the plane. Oh, speaking of which, a word about the TSA. Don't take one of these on a plane. It's way too much fun. I mean, they literally have nowhere else to go, And yes, they did tell you to turn off your wireless because it interferes with the cockpit or whatever, but does anybody do that? I guarantee you no. I know on the South by South or Southwest flight here. Well, so I decided to build this box. And then it's rocking a couple of those. It's got one problem in that I can't take it on a plane. But it is a lot of fun. So I actually had to ship that one ahead of time. I used to have a problem even with this guy. I was once going through security in San Diego, and they asked me, like, I just had it in my bag, and they pulled me aside, and they're like, sir, what is this? Oh, shit. It's my novelty router. What? Yeah, it's a Wi-Fi router, and it looks like a pineapple. They even have ones that look like coconuts. That's so cool. Yeah. Thank you, ma'am. Yeah. So now let's talk about hacking the audience. Remember the disclaimer at the top? Let's do a demo. First, let me connect to the Wi-Fi. And notice my laptop just instantly connected pineapple. I'm saying this is a huge problem across the industry. Okay, so the Range 2, is the Range 2 in the audience? Or Valhalla, Delta PC, BB1, E6 something something, DRI Revenue. How about Rob? Rob's iPhone. Who's Rob? Or BCart 4M1. I know. I'm sorry I hacked you guys. But I just wanted to make a point here. If you actually pull out your, you want to do that? You want to pull out your phone and connect? Because I've done something fun with the Wi-Fi here. I didn't do the crazy man in the middle attack spoofing and phishing and sidejacking. That was not a ringtone. Yeah. Yeah, go to any website. In fact, if you add a Wi-Fi network to your phone and just type in anything, it'll show up. Because like the mirror in Harry Potter, it is what you want it to be. So if I go to like example.com, which is my favorite website, I'll be presented with this. That's just good fun. Okay, go away, kitty. Any Wi-Fi you'd like, because it exists. Because you sent out a probe request saying, hey, is XYZ Wi-Fi around?
If you're still, if it's open, yeah, it just says, yeah, am I at this point? At this point, come on.
So then when we do that, are we really connecting to Wi-Fi?
Yes. When you do that, you're actually connecting to this guy. Or quite possibly, this guy. Which you probably didn't even notice because it looks like it's legit. It looks like it's supposed to be there. I mean, the guy at the ATM didn't notice it. Yes, good point. There is a South by Southwest 2012 network around. And so what happens in that case is if your laptop is looking for the SXSW 2012 network, and this guy is around, it's actually the one in here, what's going to happen is what's known as a race condition. And I don't know where they hide their access points here, but I'll tell you one thing, mine is closer. So when your probe request goes out, this guy sees it and instantly sends back a reply faster than the one across the hall can.
And that thing says, whatever you want to be, yes on that.
Yes. So
let's,
say again?
I see your pineapple.
Yeah, I left the SS. That's the management interface, and I left it as pineapple. If I were being smart, I might make it encrypted and change the name to something else. But you know, feel free to try to hack at it. If you can break into it, it's totally yours. So let's talk about physical access, because that was Wi-Fi, and that's fun. But when it comes to physical access, all bets are off. One of my favorite tools for physical access used to be what's known as the USB Switchblade. USB Switchblade is a cool project that we debuted in 2006. using one of these. Anybody have one of these? Okay, so the really cool thing about this drive in particular is that it has U3 technology. That doesn't mean anything. What that actually means is the neat thing about this drive was that you could plug it into, like, say, a Windows machine, and it would automatically run some portable tools. So you'd have, like, portable Firefox and portable Skype. And I really don't know why everybody wants to bring their own version of Firefox everywhere, but I guess if you use a lot of public computers, it'd be cool. And the way that it was able to pop that up automatically on those machines was because it had what's called a CDFS partition on it. It's a very special kind of thumb drive in that it shows up as not just a regular old USB mass storage, but it also shows up as a CD-ROM. And it has one of these files on it. And what that does on like a Windows box is, Windows will, and get this, when it sees one of these, for convenience, because remember, grandma has to install the printer drivers here, and the last thing she wants to do is click start, run, d:\setup.exe, parentheses, where D equals the drive letter of your CD-ROM, and that's where you lose her, because she's like, whoa, well, which one is my CD-ROM? Is it D or E or F? Well, autorun.inf solved that problem, made computers more convenient, because then you didn't have to think about it. You just pop the disk in and it runs. What could possibly go wrong? Well, they obviously didn't do this for regular thumb drives, because somebody could be malicious with that, you know? I mean, the thing about a thumb drive is it's both read and write. Unlike a CD-ROM, you're not going to write any data back to it. So I couldn't just pop this disk. I couldn't pop a CD into somebody's computer and steal some data off of their computer because it'd have nowhere to write to it. I mean, I could like open internet connections, but you know, anyway. The fun thing about that SanDisk Cruiser was that with that U3 partition, it showed up as both a thumb drive and a CD-ROM drive. And using some crafty tools, we were able to replace the CD-ROM drive with our own autorun.inf with a little bit of tools that run some hidden programs in the background, unbeknownst to the user, and then write data back to the regular thumb drive so it could steal the what's known as the hash or their SAM or this file in Windows that holds a encrypted version of their password. And when I say encrypted, I mean like encryption in the 90s, you know? So a bunch of other fun, cool stuff. You can use it to automate backups for people. So you could go by their computer and just plug this in, and then it would back up everything in their My Documents folder for them without popping up any messages to be completely covert. So it's a very nice thing to do for people because if their laptop got run over or something, they'd be really upset. So it's good that you're copying their data. And it's all for convenience, right? Well, unfortunately, Microsoft wised up to this. They actually made their own version of it and called it Coffee or something, and forensics investigators used it for a while. But they finally stopped that default behavior, and they replaced it with a little dialogue that pops up. And now you have to go through the effort of basically replacing that dialogue with your own little icon and trick them into clicking it. But it's all about trust. Do you trust your computer? Does your computer trust you? What do computers trust? They trust people. How do people interface with them? With one of these. And we don't think anything of it because we've been using these forever and ever and ever. They've gone through so many iterations. It used to be that the connector on them was like that. It was like an AT connector. And then finally the PS2 one. Remember where you'd have like a purple one and a green one? And like one was the mouse, and if you messed it up, you'd be all SOL. Well, now thankfully, everything, and this is Model M, most awesome keyboard ever. Now everything is gone USB style. And it's using this technology called a HID. So the specification of USB, a human interface device. The computer is going to use this device to interface with the humans. And so that led us to creating a rubber ducky. Because like I said, I mean, why not, right? And so what the rubber ducky does, one of these is a rubber ducky. One of them is a regular thumb drive. In fact, I'm sure a lot of you have this exact thumb drive. You do because they manufactured about umpteen bajillion of these in China, and it's like really the cheapest part. And if I put these side by side out of their cases, can you tell me which of these is a legit thumb drive and which of these is a rubber ducky? You can? Which one? The red one's the legit? Yeah. Well, you're right. The red one's the duck. You can tell because it's got this micro SD card here. And that's where we put our payloads. We'll get to that in just a second. But you know, short of cracking it open and testing that thumb drive and taking a look at it, you're probably not going to think twice about plugging this in, because in your mind, you're like, oh, this is just storage. If you've ever been to a trade show, there are people handing you these left and right engraved with their logos and silkscreened with the stuff, and then you end up at the end of the conference and you're like, all right, 512, ooh, a gigabyte, 256, come on, cheap asses, ooh, 4 gig, I'm gonna keep that one, right? We've all been there. So nobody would think twice at like South by Southwest about accepting one of these if you were like walking out of the panel and people were like, here, we're Blipster or whatever, free thumb drive, you know? All right, cool. I'll back up my photos on that or something. So let's do a quick demo. So I know all about the demo lords, so I brought a video. All right, so here's an unsuspecting PC. And as you can see, just like your grandmother's PC, it has like a bajillion icons on the desktop. And we're just gonna sneak over to it while no one's looking and really in just a few seconds plug this in. This is with the outside of the case. And what Windows will do is automatically recognize it as a USB input device. Doesn't think twice about it. This is not storage. Even though it's got a micro SD card, it's not mounting that as storage. What it's doing is showing up as a keyboard, essentially. And what do computers trust? They trust humans. How do humans interface with computers? Through keyboards. So what does this thing do in just a matter of seconds? Well, the user went to go get some coffee. Well, here we go. First thing I do is take I'm gonna minimize this. I'm slowing this down 200% so you can actually see what's going on. So I take a screenshot and I hit a couple of key combos to disappear the icons on the desktop. You know, right click, don't want the desktop. Open up Paint, who doesn't love MS Paint, and paste that picture of the desktop back when the icons were there. Now I'm gonna save the file in a directory that they can write to, hooray. And then with another key combo, I'm going to set that image now as the desktop wallpaper and I'm gonna close it. So what did I do there? It's the age-old trick. Who doesn't love that one? Because they're going to come back and they're going to try to double-click on Internet Explorer and they're not clicking on anything but a wallpaper. It's so much fun. And so you can see how this little USB rubber ducky can be, you know, taking advantage of this wonderful convenience. Here's one showing remote administration. We're bypassing user access controls. Thank you, Microsoft. That was easy. And we're writing a little bit of Visual Basic script right into the hard drive. And, you know, just as kind of like, this is our way of like showing support for the user. We want to be able to remotely manage their computer. You know, they could be at a Starbucks and we could be in, you know, wherever, and we could remotely log into their computer. You'll notice we'll pan over to this other computer right here. And what do we see? I'm going to type who am I, awesome little DOS command, and it's going to say I'm that user. This isn't that machine. So now, in just a matter of seconds, I've plugged in this drive, it's popped up a window, it wrote some code, and the computer didn't think anything of it because all of the antivirus and all of, you know, the security community is worried about these USB switchblade. They're worried about, you know, mass storage and running programs, and they don't think anything of what is being typed into the computer by the user. Why? Because the user is God. Of course we trust the user. I'm still owning you guys. Ooh, hello, Eric, and your iPhone, and Mr. iPad, and Darren, Nexus One. That's not this Darren. Anyway. So I guess we should probably talk about protecting yourself. All right. Here's a couple of good things to think about. First of all, on Wi-Fi, you could simply, if I've really scared you off Wi-Fi, you could just forego Wi-Fi altogether. And you could, like, say, use 3G or 4G or whatever the marketing people want to call it these days, like one of these. This is a dongle from Ting. They're pretty awesome. You can get a prepaid one like this one is rocking inside my crazy pineapple case of doom. This is a dongle from T-Mobile. Great thing about these are you can go and buy them in cash, like, you know, $80 for the modem. And then you can go and buy top-up cards in cash. And then you can rock your pineapple and nobody will know who you are. But it's really cheap to bring your own internet connection. That way you don't need to worry about the Wi-Fi whatsoever. There is a caveat to that. And then there's several caveats to that thereafter. and it's outside of the scope of this, but you should also be aware that on T-Mobile and AT&T, there is a threat. It's using a tool called OpenBTS. And basically, you know how this pineapple here becomes your base station for Wi-Fi? Well, with like a couple grand and some tools, hackers can now create a fake cell phone access point, basically, a cell tower of their own, and trick you into connecting to that. And it's only working on GSM. There's a lot of rumors about it working on CDMA, but that's one thing to consider. You could bring your own encryption. And so I did a piece for CBS or CNN or something like that, and they were like, well, how do you use open Wi-Fi? You know, and like, well, first of all, I don't. I bring my own, you know, dongle. It's just a fun word. But so I bring one of these, and if I am, though, going to use open Wi-Fi, of course, I bring my own encryption. The wireless access point that I'm on is not encrypted already, so I'm going to roll my own, right? And so I was like, well, you know, the simplest thing to do is use a VPN. Of course, that doesn't really mean much to a lot of people. And of course, at the end of the little 2-minute piece on Wi-Fi, the thing that they edited together, like, so use a VPN. Good night. And it's like, wait, what? What am I supposed to do? So you might want to write this down. I will throw out two favorites of mine. These are, you can either build your own if you're really geeky. OpenVPN is great for that. Or if you're not interested in, you know, learning Linux and things of that nature, you can just go to a service provider and buy yourself a VPN. The one that I like is Witopia, W-I-T-O-P-I-A. It's about $40 a year, so it's not that expensive. And what's really cool about them is that they have VPN nodes all around the world. So what'll happen is when you're at the coffee shop and you're on that unencrypted Wi-Fi network, and you're like, damn, now everyone can see my traffic. Well, if you use your VPN to tunnel to that server somewhere in the globe, let's say it's in London, right? So you're at a coffee shop here in Austin, and what you've done is you've created a secure tunnel using encryption all the way over to London, and now all of your internet traffic, anything you do on your computer, is going to go through that secure tunnel. And so from a hacker on the outside, even if you've connected to my Wi-Fi pineapple, all I'm going to see is garbage. So another one is Viper VPN, VYPR. And I think there's, if you just Google some VPN service providers, you'll find them. The nice thing about Witopia, though, like I said, if I was tunneling to London, and this is just kind of a freebie, is that now all my traffic is going through London, and it bypasses GOIP restrictions. So what that means is if I go to the BBC, I can now watch the BBC iPlayer and watch Doctor Who all day long because they think I'm in London. I know, right? In fact, we do the same thing. I run a VPN server for some of my friends in Canada and overseas so that they can tunnel into the United States and use Hulu because they can't get it overseas. You could also use an SSH tunnel. It's a lot more geeky. But if that rings a bell, you can probably figure out how to use that, and it's not hard at all, but you need your own server. But what I should mention here is what you are doing, though, is you're on, say, on an unencrypted wireless access point at the coffee shop here in Austin. And so you VPN to London, and then what happens there? Some magic? Well, no, what happens is your traffic becomes unencrypted, and then from there bounces over to the server you're connecting to. Okay, so really all you're doing is you're shifting the endpoint of where that unencrypted data is going out. Obviously, you don't want it going out unencrypted at the open Wi-Fi at the coffee shop in Austin, but now I'm just mentioning this because when you go looking for a VPN service provider, think about it, because basically you're giving them all of your unencrypted traffic. So you got to think about, again, trust. And then convenience, of course. This is why I run my own VPN server. It's a lot harder to do, but at least this way I know that the only people that could sniff it are, again, my internet service provider. It all comes down to that. You could use encrypted Wi-Fi. I noticed that there is a South by Southwest encrypted Wi-Fi. Did you say, though, that's not for guests? That really sucks, man. Like, they need to do something about this. At the hacker conferences, all of the Wi-Fi is encrypted. Well, they actually keep an unencrypted Wi-Fi network, but it's really kind of like a Wild West. If you're connecting to that, you're connecting to that because you are trying to nuke the planet. So, of course, this doesn't really work in a convenient society. For example, at an airport concourse, if I go to San Francisco International, they've got the SFO free Wi-Fi, right? And they allow you 45 minutes of free Wi-Fi unless you change your MAC address, and then you can get back on with even more Wi-Fi for free. But the thing about that is it's totally unencrypted, and it kind of has to be, because otherwise, in addition to the TSA has now limited the amount of liquid you can take, you could also hear, and the wireless encryption is EEF5204D6A. You don't want to hear that. Nobody cares, right? It just needs to be open and easy and convenient. So the use encrypted Wi-Fi kind of isn't like a really good suggestion, in that you're probably not going to run into situations where that's a thing. Hopefully that changes. Hopefully maybe next year at South by Southwest they do a WPA encrypted network as well. And then just, you know, give us the key even in our badge. It doesn't matter if we all know the key, because then each of our sessions are encrypted. And I should probably mention that connecting to WPA secures you against this attack, because the Wi-Fi Pineapple cannot mimic a WPA encrypted wireless network. When you're looking for networks and your phone's automatically connecting to them, like these guys, they connected to, and if I scroll down here, it'll show me what they thought they connected to. Most of them are just South by Southwest 2012. This one got connected to 107 JSON. Just got another one. Anyway, those folks are connecting to wireless access points that they have remembered that are open. And if you connect to a WPA encrypted network, this isn't going to give the hacker anything, because it can't mimic one of those. And the reason for that is that the way that WPA works is it doesn't just say, oh, what's the password? And you go, the password is beef. Well, it actually does this crazy cool four-way handshake thing where nobody reveals anything really. And you can't really mimic that, because it would just throw off the laptop instantly. And you can't see it, but down there it says, disable remember this network. So you could tell your phone or your tablet or your laptop every single time you're on a network, you connect to it, and then remember when you disconnect from that network to tell it to forget it. So remember to forget that. On your home Wi-Fi, please don't use WEP. It's crap. It's like you can crack it in like 30 seconds, and no, MAC address authentication isn't going to save you either. What you should be using, log into your router. It's usually 192.168.1.1. Password's admin. Change that too. Is that you want to enable WPA to PSK. It's the way to go, right? And use a long-ass passphrase, something like, Mary had a little lamb, or something. The other thing that you need to do while you're logged in there, in addition to changing your password, is to disable this thing called WPS. WPS is so cool. It's this technology that was created, get this, for convenience. There's a button on the front of your router, you may have noticed. And so you press that button on your router, and then you press the button on your laptop, and then they sync up. It's so great, right? It's kind of like syncing your Wiimote to your Wii, where you hold down the red buttons and you're all like, you know, it's like pairing Bluetooth, if you've ever done that. What's the password on Bluetooth? 0000. I love that for convenience again. Well, there's this really cool tool that just came out called Reaver. Not that Reaver. And yes, my coat is brown and I got it on sale. And it basically takes down WPS really, really, really easily. So disable that. It's fun how these things that are created for convenience are really easy to hack. And keep in mind that encryption is only one layer. I can't, in all honesty, stand up here and tell you guys to all build a network with a DMZ and VPNs internally to get access to your stuff. But just keep in mind that just by turning on all of these things are not going to save you. You still have to follow best practices. As far as USB drives are concerned, you know, there's no real good answer right now, because short of inspecting every chip, which is fun in its own right, it's kind of hard to tell like what is legit and what isn't. You could use a clean box. You could take that, you know, the last year's MacBook, you know, your old one that you just upgraded from, and you could use that to plug your stuff into and make sure it's okay. You want to use this thing called DBAN or Derek's Boot and Nuke. You want to completely wipe that drive of any information, and then that will be your clean box, right? Unfortunately, this will not work in a virtual machine. So if you go and get VMware or whatever for your machine, and you're thinking, oh, well, I'll just have my clean machine be a virtual machine, that's really not going to work, because of the way that vendor IDs and product IDs work in USB. So in the protocol, I could show up as one drive, and then a moment later, show up as another and really trick your virtual machine. So this is a fun one, though. Holding down shift, turns out, it totally thwarted the USB thumb drive, or the USB switchblade, and it will also thwart the USB rubber ducky. Actually, control would be a better key, because all it's doing is mimicking the keyboard. So since you have now two keyboards on your system, holding down control or shift is going to F up whatever it's trying to do. But like I said, there is no good solution right now. Hopefully that's kind of like an industry thing that needs some attention, really. On a Mac, you plug in a PC keyboard, doesn't it like pop up something? You have to click some stuff to make it work. But otherwise, like on a Windows machine or a Linux machine, it doesn't really care. It's like, ooh, a keyboard. You know, the really fun thing is like even in the BIOS, you know, so you got a BIOS password, doesn't matter. You boot up your computer, you plug this guy into it, and it can start typing in passwords and hitting enter all day long. And what's really fun is Windows servers, get this. So you ever type in your password more than like 3 times and then it locks you out and it's like, listen, buddy, you obviously aren't who you say you are. Come back in 10 minutes and try again. The reason they do that 10-minute lockout is because otherwise hackers could just, you know, brute force and bust into anything. So as far as online attacks are concerned, brute force does not work. But if you're at the keyboard, Microsoft decided with Windows Server, well, you can try as many passwords as you like. Because, you know, you're the human. How fast can you type? And administrators have to remember so many. Was it the mail server password or the FTP server password? Or was it Exchange? And, you know, if you've ever done admin work, you know that you got like 14 bajillion passwords. So you can sit there all day long typing them in. Let's talk about not being stupid. You might want to go over to twitterfisher.com. They have a special now. It's a very new social network. It's everybody's signing up, doing it. It's really, really cool. Twitter, Fisher, without an E, of course, .com. It's a site that I set up years ago. And it says right on it, this is a phishing attack. And it has a username and password prompt for Twitter. And mostly I get garbage, but I do log everything that goes through there, and you would not believe the amount of people that will just give their credentials away. So please, don't be that person that just gives your credentials away. If you're going to sign up for a service that uses Twitter or Facebook or something like that, make sure it does the open authorization kind of thing, or pops up, takes you to Twitter, and then Twitter says, do you want to allow this site? Also be careful what you post and who you friend. There's this really cool tool called Maltego, which is awesome for data mining. Like I said, if I were to do that phishing attack on Facebook, get your password, now I can like log in and like just, you know, friends of friends of friends, and next thing you know, I've got like a huge map of your entire social graph or whatever. Well, just be careful who you friend. The FBI is like friending everyone just for this reason. Use two-factor authentication. So if you haven't already, if you're using Gmail, you need to enable two-factor authentication. It's right there in your user settings, and it's awesome because what that does is now for me to log into my Google Apps, I give it my password, which is something I know, but it won't let me log in until I pull up the app on my phone, something I have, and enter in the numbers that it gives me there. Another two-factor authentication thing is a YubiKey. This right here, it's like $2 or something. Go to Yubico or just Google YubiKey. These are super cheap, and they will work with password managers like LastPass. And they are, again, something you have. This is actually a USB drive. Get this. When I plug this in, so if I were to log into hack5.org, my website, I can give my username and my password, but I can't log in until I plug this physical thing into my machine. So I both have to have my password. So even if somebody steals my password, they'd have to kidnap me to... That's not good. Well, regardless, it's now like an added layer of security, and this is a very good thing. And what I was going to mention about this is the YubiKey. So cool. You plug it in the USB port, and it types. That's how it gets the one-time password on there. It shows up as a keyboard. So we're obviously not going to start thwarting against those anytime soon, because this technology is used for both good and evil, like all technology. Get the HTTPS Everywhere plugin. I believe it's for both Firefox and Chrome now. And it's supported by the EFF, and it's basically just a little plugin that makes sure that when you're going to like Facebook or Gmail or Twitter or whatever, that you're using HTTPS. This isn't the only solution. This is just in addition to not being stupid, but you want to do that because there's these cool tools called SSL Strip that hackers can use to basically drop that S. And so now you go to the website, and the security's gone. It gets really cool, and it's outside of the scope, and we're almost out of time, but that's what it does. Full disk encryption. If you have the option on your operating system to do full disk encryption, please do it. If you don't, TrueCrypt is an awesome way to do it. In addition, TrueCrypt, you should definitely be writing this down, Googling this, because TrueCrypt allows you to create encrypted volumes that you can store files in addition to creating hidden volumes, which gives you plausible deniability, which is perfect for border crossings. Because when you're in a border, you don't have any rights. So you give them the password to the regular volume and not the hidden volume, and then Bob's your uncle. So remote recovery. You want to do this now. if you haven't already. PrayProject.org is only one of them. But when your laptop gets stolen, you're really going to wish that you had this, because something like Pray gives you the opportunity to, it's kind of like a Find My iPhone or Remote Wipe, but it allows you to do that on Android devices, on Linux, on Windows, on Mac, things like that. So, and then, of course, nuke your machine before you recycle it, because there's nothing more fun than going over to eBay and buying used hard drives and finding all sorts of fun data. So, like I said, Derek's Boot Nuke is a great utility for doing that. You just want to kind of, you know, rewrite all the data multiple times over before you recycle those. So, in conclusion, the computer-human trust model is flawed. I mean, it's inherently flawed, just like us. And convenience is a curse. I don't have any solutions to this. I'm just letting you know. It's kind of an industry-wide problem. And computers aren't toasters, and neither are we. So say we all. I'm Darren Kitchen.